Hi, guys. We want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is the charming and delightful Kate Flannery.
How are you?
Well,
I think you mean what's your order?
Taking your charm and delight. That's how I am. And you know her, you love her. I mean, you saw her for 9 years on The Office. I mean, 9 incredible years.
I was the drunken floozy. Incredible drunken floozy.
Meredith.
It's typecasting. I get it. I get it.
My dad owned a bar, so I do come by it, honestly. I will say that.
And this very weekend, as this program is airing, she is part of the TCM Classic Film Festival here in Hollywood, as am I. And it's a wonderful event. And I'm so glad you're part of it.
Me too. I look forward to it every year. I can't believe it's 10 years old.
We were there the first year.
Me too.
We were there the first year.
It's grown so much, right? I know. And the super fans and some people that feel like they may not get out of their house very much, but they do come to this festival,
which is
fantastic.
And they're so happy to be there.
Yes.
Genuinely happy to be there.
Our favorite thing is people come over because husbands give it to wives. Wives give it to husbands as birthday presents.
Yes, because it ain't cheap.
That's it. No, people come over to us. They go, oh, so my husband surprised me. He wrote me this whole story. Like, they come over and tell you the whole thing of why they're there.
Yeah.
And it just makes it that much
It's awesome.
Much
and
nicer.
I've seen, some aging parents with their kids on a trip that they normally wouldn't take.
Yes.
It's fantastic.
There are generations.
It's really,
It's not a sea of blue hair. It really is not.
I mean, there's me, but
But it is, but there's a lot of hot dogs and purses and people who don't want to leave the theater. They bring, secret food in their bag so they don't miss a thing. There's just so much to see.
And it's been amazing. My husband as a normal person, which is that he didn't watch a lot of this stuff.
Right.
So the fact that I got to introduce him to Harold Lloyd while sitting with Sue Lloyd.
How fantastic.
And the Alloy Orchestra. And we get to watch Safety Last on a big screen.
Isn't that great?
And that's not, of course, I think anybody will enjoy Harold Lloyd any day, but that is the perfect way. So for me to get to say to my husband, I'm going to show you this movie that I love in a room full of people who love it too.
I'm glad it worked out because that could have been the end of a perfectly good relationship.
It's over. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Because he knows the threats.
So what are your duties this weekend?
I am presenting the film High Society.
Whoa.
Which is a tall order, but I'm so excited because I'm at the new... They're using this space was recently renovated, the American Legion Hall.
I'm
excited.
To see it.
It's on Highland. I've passed it a million times.
Yeah. Yep.
It almost looks like a giant square wedding cake or some sort of a party cake. But I guess they renovated it and they put money into it. And I'm so excited to just be part of the unveiling. And hopefully I don't stink up the joint.
I can't wait to see it.
Me too. And, I'm so excited about High Society because, I was just raised in front of the TV. I'm one of 7 kids. And I just feel like movies were just black and white movies were my life. I mean, mm-hmm. I was always attracted to it, even with the color TV. I didn't care. But I will say, High Society, being an Irish Catholic woman, actress from Philadelphia, we were always so aware of the Kelly family because they also had a house in Ocean City, New Jersey, down the shore.
We're talking about Grace Kelly.
Grace Kelly,
Grace Kelly's famous uncle, the playwright George Kelly.
Well, actually, I'm more talking about her father and her brother.
Father.
Yes, her brother. Her father was an Olympic rower, 3-time gold medal, and her... her brother was also an Olympic bronze medalist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. different Olympics.
So that name looms large then.
This is true. Yeah. And they actually have a giant road named after John B. Kelly, Kelly Drive.
Wow.
And that's how you get into the city.
I'm learning all this from you.
Yes. Yeah. In the 1980s, they dedicated. It's along the Schuylkill River. And if you see it, you won't be able to spell it again. It's the weirdest spelling. It's an Indian name. But so Philadelphia has always been very aware of every move that Grace Kelly's made.
And this was one of her last movies in Hollywood.
Yes, it was. Yes.
And married Prince Rainier.
Right. And she wore her actual engagement ring in the film.
Oh,
and
really?
It looked bigger than life because it was.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? She asked.
I appreciate these fun facts.
I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I know.
Terrific.
I love that. Yeah.
And you guys at home, you're getting this for free.
That's right. That's right. You don't have to go to
TPM. No passes. No hot dogs in your pocket. What? I mean, or whatever. That doesn't sound right. I'm sorry.
No. You know our family. That's exactly how it goes.
And what else are you doing?
And I'm presenting with Dave Karger. We're just going to do a Q&A before Love in the Afternoon, which is a Billy Wilder film with Audrey Hepburn and Gary Cooper.
And Maurice Chevalier.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And I used to wait on Billy Wilder at Kate Manolini restaurant in Beverly Hills. So I have some limited but specific knowledge of Billy Wilder. And there was so much chemistry between the two of us. I'm kidding. There's none. That's okay.
You brought that macaroni and cheese around the corner.
He always had the same thing. He had calves, brains, and eggs every time he came in. And he'd have a short martini, and he'd split a piece of apple pie with whoever he was dining with. Very consistent. Very consistent.
Wow. Now, we have to explain this. This restaurant was an exceptional restaurant.
Yes.
That a lot of people I know, miss to this very day.
Yes. It was definitely built on an ancient burial ground. Everyone in Hollywood came up, all ages, shapes, and sizes.
Short walk from the Academy of Motion Picture
Arts
and Sciences.
That's right.
Which has member screenings of new movies every weekend, all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
Also, so this was also the, like, where we'd go before high holiday services because our temple's down the street.
Of course, right. Yes, yes.
But
Kate Manolini was a big part of the Academy experience. Yeah. I used to have to go in at 5 a.m. the days that they would announce the Oscars because they would have they would come over for Bloody Marys right after. Yeah. That was their tradition. The thing is that, you know, when you hope and pray to work with the greats, be specific. Because I was around them all the time, but I couldn't get arrested in a way. You know, but I was just still playing. I'd audition for things, I'd test for things, and I'd wait on the producers that night. You know, but that's how it goes. You kind of have
LA.
To make peace with it, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very show business. It's just the myth of the actor waiter. And, you know, I was hustling and working as hard as I could, but I was getting up there. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I was 40 years old when I got the office. I'd had some successes off Broadway and had done some co-star, and I worked at Second City, of course, years before that in Chicago. But, you know, you never know, and you just got to keep doing what you do. So if there's any, you know, people that are doing one thing but trying to do another, may I say, I'm the poster child for hang in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are all different attitudes toward that, as you know.
Yes,
you know,
there
some
are.
People have very good. You know, keep your head down and keep moving.
Right.
Attitude. And then I read a long time ago, Lawrence Kasdan, the writer and director, made, you know, The Big Chill and Silverado and gosh knows how many other movies, not to mention Raiders of the Lost Ark and all that stuff.
Which one's that? I'm just kidding.
Yeah. It's a little, little thing.
He worked in advertising for years while he was trying to become a screenwriter. And his advice, based on his own experience, is take a job you hate. So that you never forget what you really want to be doing.
This is true. This is true. Kate Manolini was not my favorite job. I mean, there were things about it that I loved, but the people I worked for were tough. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, we got yelled at a lot. You know, there's a lot of moody people with a lot of power that, you know, if they're having a tough day, they're going to take it out on the waiter. So it prepared me for being on a set. It gave me a thick skin. You know, but it does motivate you if you let it. You're either going to go all the way or you're going to get out and do something else. It's really when you get pushed that hard.
Well, but see, I always say to people, anyone who the audition process on its own tells you whether or not you can handle this.
Right.
Because I can tell you now that I couldn't.
Right.
I never wanted to be an actor or anything like that, but taking friends, as I did all the time, on their behalf. I was upset.
Right.
And it was the kind of thing where I thought, this is how I know it's not something I want, because my God, you just have to if you love it that much that that's the only job you can do, then you do it.
That's
the
thing.
And you deal with the constant rejection.
This is true. But hopefully you have therapy and some decent support system and stay away from the people that don't really support you because you can't afford them at a certain point. You can't pick yourself up and them too.
That's a perfect way to say it, though.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, so we are. So you loved watching old movies. You grew up with a TV set as your portal.
Yes,
to
this is
true. Wonderful world.
And my dad always knew all the character actors. I'm the youngest of seven kids, so my dad was 40 when I was born. So he was raised, like, he would go to the movies in the early 30s, and he... So watching an old movie with him was reliving his childhood.
Sure.
And of course, he was in World War II. And so some movies he missed when he was away because he was a prisoner of war for over a year in Germany. And
oh my.
So he would kind of be, you know, there were some things like some gaps to fill in when he came back. Uh-huh. And so he would always talk about that. So I always felt like it was a way for us to become close. But my dad always said to me, who is that? Who's that character actor? You tell me that. You come back and you tell me who that is. So it was a little game we used to play. So I always knew who Mary Wicks was and, you know, James Gleason. I mean, there were so many great, wonderful supporting players that just had, because of the studio system, they got to play so much. And
yes,
they were so
they
important.
Worked all the time.
Yes, and they were so important to the jigsaw puzzle of each movie.
Oh, yeah. They're part of the fabric of those movies.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we couldn't do it without them.
No, indeed.
No.
God bless Ed Brophy and Nat Pendleton.
Oh,
and every single
Zazu
one of them.
Zazu Pitts. Oh, my God. Yep. Come on.
One of the greatest
Patsy
names.
Kelly. Come on.
So
many great.
So, all right. So now you've fallen in love with movies.
Yes.
It helps you bond with your dad.
Yes.
Which is great.
I don't get it.
And what was your first step toward...
Performing.
Well, something to do with show business.
Well, I played the piano by ear, which was kind of like my first little, like, I'd watch something in a movie and then I'd try to play it on the piano. And it was bugging my older sister because she was taking lessons and she couldn't play by ear. She had a but I wanted to be an actress as a kid. And my mother was like, no. And I would write compositions about it. And then when I was about 13, I started to go for any local audition. I grew up in Philadelphia. So anything, any dinner theater, if I could get myself there, I would go. Amateur show. I had auditioned for the Chief Halftown amateur show. I didn't get it. I got beat out by three sisters who were, they were a contortionist act and they were chained to the neck and the foot and their act was tangling and detangling.
Whoa.
Yeah. But, you know,
I don't think it's a disgrace to lose to that act.
I guess not. I don't know. It kind of hurts still. But I was I became obsessed with the show Annie because I was about the same age as Andrew McArdle, who was the star. And then I was trying to, you know, I had auditioned for Al Albert's Showcase, which was Al Albert's from the Four Aces. He had his own amateur show. And I sang the same song everyone sang. They all sang Annie. I was like, but my strategy was I was going to sing it better than anybody. So I did not get that. And there was a woman that got on who she said, play the entertainer. And she had some like carnival hat, like styrofoam hat and a cane. And she's like, yeah, la, 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 la. She got on and I didn't because she said she had a stroke and she taught herself how to walk again. This is kind of early, you know, America's Got Talent where you have to have a sob story.
Right.
I didn't get that part. Yeah, I didn't. I don't really plug in. I don't respond to that part as well. I mean, I get it, but I don't like it. So anyway, so I had some knocks, some blows, but I actually wanted to study voice when I was in eighth grade. And my mother said, you already have tap and piano. Your sister only has swimming. That's it. You want to do it, you figure it out. So I worked in a Chinese restaurant one night a week that my older sister worked in. And I that's what paid for my first voice lessons. And then I, you know, kind of figured out, like, if you want something and you don't know how to do it or if you're not great at it, it's going to require some effort and some study and some just, like, really, you know, those hard knocks. For some reason, I got that at an early age. I'm not sure why, but
What did you like to sing?
I like to sing Broadway tunes and the old standards and stuff I heard in movies. I loved Fred and Ginger movies and Gershwin and Harold Arlen.
You can't
so
go
many
wrong.
Greats.
It's
no,
not, yeah.
no, absolutely. And anything Judy Garland sang was fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
The bar was high, though, because, you know, I mean, nobody starts out singing like Judy Garland, but Judy Garland.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, you and Jesse have one important thing in common. Your great love of Ethel Merman.
This is true. Oh, oh, yes.
I didn't tell Jesse yes. this ahead of time.
I didn't know that.
I have to tell you this.
I love her
I was
so
obsessed
much.
With her. She was on a TV show, That Girl, with Marlo Thomas in the 60s. It was, ran reruns all the time. And I was like, who? And she was also in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Mm-hmm. And hilarious. Hilarious. She did a few musicals. There's No Business Like Show Business with Mitzi Gaynor and Donald O'Connor. But still, her comedy was so funny. My oldest sister, who's 13 years older than me, got me tickets to see Ethel Merman sing with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I think it was the summer between my 7th and 8th grade. And she was in her 70s. I was mesmerized by her. I had such a profound experience seeing her live. She was really incredible.
My mom saw her in Gypsy.
Oh,
my mom
come
saw her on.
On
Broadway in Gypsy.
Oh my God.
As is, now my mom got to see Yul Brynner. My mom did those kinds of things. So as is, I have extreme, you know, my jealousy knows no bounds. Same thing though, my dad saw Ella Fitzgerald and Mel Torme and all the rest. And again,
well
I feel like I could kill them for having gotten to do. So the only issue in our household was that because my mom played all of the Ethel Merman stuff over and over again, I thought that's how one should sing.
Of course, of course.
So Jesse, who loved music and studied music, Jesse definitely thought that she should sound like Ethel Merman. And I refer to me in the third person because that was how young I was. So I quite literally would walk around going, And I my teacher, my choir teacher in third grade said, Jess, I love that you love Ethel. I get it. She's incredible. But no one else needs to sound like that. No one in the world needs to sound like that. And it was the hardest thing in the world for me to go,
I understand.
He said, you don't go off key on purpose. I said, but she goes off key on purpose. You're supposed to go off key on purpose. What are you talking about? It took some practice to not sound like Ethel Merman.
Well, yeah. And I think Ethel Merman reminded everyone that no one else could sound like
God.
Ethel Merman either.
Yeah.
I mean, she was very, you know, she had one thing and she did it well. Never had a voice lesson. Remember, she used to brag about that on the talk shows.
My favorite, one of my favorite
really?
Things
no
is when she's singing, You're Just in Love.
You're not sick, you're just in love, yep.
And
get your gun.
To me, it's always that it looks a bit like a cartoon where when she turns her head to sing at the young actor to whom she is serenading, it looks like a cartoon where he's like blowing backwards as she's going, you don't need analyzing.
It's like the old Pioneer commercial where his hair is just, there's just wind coming out of her mouth.
That's how I always feel.
You are right on.
I love her so much.
I understand, and I'm sorry that you.
And my mother absolutely at all times, sing out, Louise, the whole thing. I can do every bit of Ethel in my
is amazing.
So
you made the mistake. You brought it up.
And I'm paying the price. But back to you.
Yes. yes.
So you went to high school.
I did. Actually, I was going to bring one more thing up about Ethel Merman.
Yeah.
Last summer,
go
I got
right
to
ahead.
Sing with the orchestra in the Ocean City, New Jersey, the Ocean City Pops. It was a boardwalk I used to work on. I've spent every summer of my life there. And an evening. They asked me to sing Everything's Coming Up Roses. Uh-huh. So I did. And I had an out-of-body experience. I was so emotional afterwards because I thought, I'm like the right age. I'm not quite as old as Ethel was when I saw. I think she was like 70. I'm getting there. But no, yeah. But I had such a profound experience like singing that song with an orchestra in front of my family. It was just crazy. That was crazy.
Wow.
But anyways, and I just realized that it takes so much courage to keep going in this business. And, you know, she's one of the greats. Like, she just kept showing up, no matter what was on the – I mean, she was even in the movie Airplane.
Yes,
she is.
Doing a parody of herself.
One of my favorite jokes in that movie.
It's a great joke. And how smart for her to have a good enough sense of humor about herself to let that happen.
Indeed.
So, yes. Anyway,
what a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. But when I was a senior in high school, I actually booked one of the dinner theater jobs, and my mother actually let me do it. So I was in Bye Bye Birdie at the Riverfront Dinner Theater, and we had 9 shows a week.
Oh,
we were not allowed to eat the seafood Newberg. If we had a matinee, we could help ourselves at the buffet, but no seafood Newberg. And they gave me a song for the movie because I was playing Ursula, and Ursula didn't have a song in the original show, but they gave me Anne Margaret's song from the credits.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Birdie, The Army's Got You Now. So it was nice. So I had a little, you know, it was good. I got some good reviews, but I still, you know, I felt like a child star because I got to leave after fourth period because I had a matinee. I was kind of excited on Wednesdays.
Great.
And also, the year before that, I was a featured extra in the movie Taps.
Uh-huh.
So I actually got to know, just peripherally for a few weeks, Tom Cruise and Sean Penn and Timothy Hutton.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, it was crazy. But you know what? My facial expressions were so big that when we went to do the scene where George C. Scott gets shot, I got taken out because I was too. I was playing in the back of the house, and it was a movie.
Uh-huh.
So I just remember being so heartbroken over that. I mean, I was still involved, but I was like, oh no. Like once I saw the movie, I was like, oh no.
But it's another learning. I mean, that's a big one.
Yeah.
And
that's a tough one.
We talk about it a lot. That one of the toughest things. My dad always says that you have to meet a movie on its own terms. It's something he repeats constantly, especially to his students. He teaches at USC.
So awesome. And how lucky those students are to have
21
you.
Years. 21 God, years he's so been great. Teaching. But that's one of those things where with certain films, even he will notice it's a bit over the top. Yep. Certain performances are a bit over the top.
Yeah,
you don't just know.
No,
you don't magically know how to change because what do we learn in the theater? To the very back.
Yeah, and at the age of 16, I was like, I didn't know from anything. And I remember the producers being on set. I think it was Stanley Jaffe. I just remember observing because I was there for a few weeks, so that's a long time. And we weren't. I did some crowd stuff too. But my mother actually, we did some crowd stuff together, which was hilarious that she actually got involved. She was so but I remember just being such an observer of the process and kind of learning. And Timothy Hutton actually won his Academy Award during that filming. So he actually brought it in and I saw it and I was like, oh my gosh, it was kind of profound. It's funny, I actually talked to him at the upfronts when The Office, he was on a show for NBC about 12 years ago, and The Office was there, and we actually got to speak at Radio City Music Hall, and we all went on stage, and I thought, this is such a weird, my life is so bizarre that here I am, all these years later, talking to Timothy Hutton, and he actually is willing to talk to me because I'm an actor, you know? So that experience had an effect on me. And then when I was, after the dinner theater show ended, I was an extra in the movie Eddie and the Cruisers. And I actually missed my senior prom because I had a close-up of this one thing, so I was not going to leave it. Yeah, it was during the filming of the song On the Dark Side. So if you ever see that movie, I'm still acting my ass off. I'm clapping. I'm clapping weird, whatever. But there is a few seconds of me in this red sweater set and a little plaid, you know, in the front row, being extremely enthusiastic.
But that's so cool.
Well, those are great opportunities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there was no casting couch involved. It was really a no harm, no foul. It was, and then I ended up going to school for theater. And
where?
I first went to Shenandoah Conservatory and College in Winchester, Virginia, because one of my best friends was there a year ahead. And I got a partial scholarship. And I studied voice, I studied musical theater, and I really enjoyed it. But I started to realize that, unfortunately, in the 80s, women in musicals, their category got, the funny women got the axe. Because Andrew Lloyd Webber came in, and the creators of Les Mis, and there really wasn't that second banana, that female second banana that there used to be. There was always, in Oklahoma, there was 8 O'Annie.
Right.
There was Meg and Brigadoon. It's just, there was something that was just... It was just shifting, and I thought, I feel like nobody has a sense of humor. Mm. So I ended up transferring to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and I had a pretty good experience there. And it's interesting because the 2 years that I had at Shenandoah studying voice, I'm using more now in my 40s and 50s than I did in my 20s and 30s. It's interesting because I've been singing with Jane Lynch in this band, and I have to really use all these muscles that I wasn't even sure I had anymore. It's crazy.
It's
interesting. Well, I do now, but I feel Jane Lynch is one of those people that had more faith in me than I had in myself. I was like, I don't know if I could. I mean, I could do some stuff recording in a studio, but to do it live, and we've been doing these really big tours, and they've been wonderful. But at first, I've always had some anxiety. I'm not sure I can reproduce this every time. You have
human.
To have some tricks.
But apparently,
that's
you can.
Human.
I can. I mean, sometimes there's Mexican prednisone involved, but I don't want to mention that. No, but it's a lot. Shane and I got to do 10 shows at the Carlisle in September, and
pinnacle. If you're working in the much shrunken world of cabaret, which is almost gone, but
yes.
Thank goodness, hanging on by a thread.
Yes,
the pinnacle. is the Cafe Carlyle.
This is so true.
At the Hotel Carlyle in Manhattan.
I know.
It's where Bobby Short held court for years. I was lucky enough to see him there.
Gosh.
My wife and I were.
I waited on him once at Cape Mentally. Seriously, everybody that would come from New York would always come to Cape Mentally.
But just after we met you, you sent me a text saying, you know, oh, by the way, we're going to be at Vibrato.
Yes, yeah.
Which again, you know, LA doesn't have a lot of that sort of stuff anymore. Vibrato's a big deal.
Yeah, it's Herb Albert's club. It's amazing. If you ever get a chance to go, I don't think you're going to have a bad experience. But, you know, we get to sing with this great band, the Tony Guerrero Quintet, and it's just working with great musicians and people that you trust and people that sort of push you a little out of your comfort zone from time to time, you know.
So, let's go back to this. All right. So now you went to this Philadelphia Conservatory.
Right.
And were you working at the same time, or did you just do schoolwork?
I worked too. I waited tables. I was living at home. I had some student loans. And I was waiting tables at a place called the 16th Street Bar and Grill. It's actually still there, but they changed the name. And one of the bartenders is still there on Sunday nights. He's been there forever since 1980. None of your business. But I think it's called the Monk's Club, something like that. But yeah. So I was always on the hustle. I do think that so much about any business, but particularly show business, is like the more you show up, things come back to you in ways that you don't even understand. It's like every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more. You cast your bread upon the waters. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you don't know if or when
it's
going to come back and repay you. But often it does.
It does, and the harder you work, I think there's, you know, as long as it's smart enough, and it's not, if you're not banging your head against the same wall, and there's blood coming down, you know, you just have to be careful not to bruise yourself. It's interesting. When I was a senior in college, my mom's sister, who had lived in Chicago since the early '60s, she sent me a ticket to check out Second City. And to stay with her because she thought it would be a good fit. Because right after graduation, I was working in a comedy club or a comedy group in Philadelphia. We played a bunch of different clubs, but I was kind of getting the bug. And I'll never forget my first time I ever went to Second City. We figured this out later. Jane Lynch was understudying for Bonnie Hunt, and Bonnie Hunt came back for the improv set in her wedding dress. Which was hilarious. I don't think the marriage lasted very long, but I'm just saying, I mean, that's like a, whoa, you're making a choice. But it was like one of those things where it was such a magical night. Because I remember Mike Myers came back in. I mean, I've since, like, we've had these conversations, I've done the math afterwards, but I ended up studying at Second City, and then I got hired. I was in the touring company, and I worked with Jill Soloway at the Annoyance Theater and Mick Napier, all these great people, and got to do a bunch of shows. And just really sort of started my career in Chicago in such a great, fun way, where we did things that made fun of musicals. And Lauren Michaels came, and I was up for SNL, but didn't get it. My friends, you know, I had a friend that got it instead. And at first, thanks to therapy, I'm okay about it. But at first, I was like, oh my gosh, that's usually the end of that road. You know, that's the dream.
Yeah.
That's what you're ramping up toward. But I realized that they don't consider just anyone. So you just have to take it, you know, as a sign, you know, you have to recognize the affirmation, not the negative part. And I was waiting tables at Kate Mantellini probably, I want to say like 12 years after I got rejected from SNL. And I saw one of the producers, Mike Shoemaker, who was on that lunch with me. He was having lunch with or dinner with Tina Fey. This is before she was really famous. She was just a writer on the show at the time. And he said, hang in there, don't give up. And I think 2 or 3 years later, I got The Office. So, you know, it's just those things. I don't wish this path. I mean, it's so less encouraging to young talent these days because it's so hard.
Yeah.
I'm just, but it's, you know, but again, it's like if you have enough breadcrumbs, if you have enough light, if you have enough good things to happen and good feeling and good reviews, then it's worth it. You know, I mean, I had some off-Broadway stuff in the meantime. I moved to New York to do, I moved to LA to do a stage production of the movie Valley of the Dolls. And it ended up going off-Broadway, so I went back to New York. So it was kind of a double thing. But, you know, and it didn't pay very well, so I had to wait tables during the day. I was doing like 8 shows a week, playing Neely O'Hara, the Patty Duke part.
There's a theme here, folks.
There is.
Do you ever go to Stardust in New York, the Stardust
Diner?
Yes,
of course.
Where my mom always says, stop singing and give me my dinner. It's one of those places where all the waiters and waitresses sing.
Of course.
And so every now and then you're like, could I just get some more water? I'm so sorry if I
so true.
I love your number, man, but just screw it.
I was only a singing waitress one day, and I thought the show was so horrible. And one person was like, "That was great." Another person was like, "That was horrible." So I'm like, "I'm out of there." Like, yeah. I'm such a high critic of like, I couldn't do it.
But everything you're saying, again, like being a part of Second City is not small.
No, it was a great affirmation. That's another huge deal.
Yeah. And we know how many people came out of that and continue. I mean, it's not still a big deal.
No, absolutely.
You know, and obviously here in LA we have UCB, and UCB is in New York too, but like these are also,
and the original UCB, you know, I mean, the two Matts used to work at the Annoyance Theater with me, and I knew them from Second City. I mean, you know, we're all so connected. Yeah. Like it's really, Don't piss anybody off. We're connected.
Oh, God,
you know,
well,
I'm just saying.
Well.
Don't act like a douchebag.
Well, you know, that was one of the many, 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 many lessons I learned when I came out here for the first time working for Entertainment Tonight. I went to a party. They had a party for people who had already been fired from the show. And they invited some people who were still working on the show who they liked. So that was a nice gesture to invite me. And I was talking with somebody who had just gotten canned. And the producer who had fired him was standing 6 feet away. And I said to him, I said, "Isn't it tough being in the same room with the guy who let you go?" And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Well, you know, you never know. 6 months from now, I could be working for him again. Or we could be sitting side by side at adjacent desks. You never tell anybody to screw off."
Really smart person.
As much as you dream, as much we all have the dream of going, oh,
yeah.
But it just doesn't work.
No,
I wish.
No.
I wish we all could. I wish that we could all have the moment of going, "Evag you."
Yeah. I kept my restaurant job through the first season of The Office because I didn't know if we were going to get picked up.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when I actually gave my notice, I think I'd been there on and off for 7 years, and my boss said, "We were going to get you a cake, but you'll be back." And I was back, but just as a customer. But I still have dreams about having to pick up a shift.
Oh my
I have
God.
The uniform, and then I'm like, "No, it's closed."
How can you not?
And then I go, "Wait, it's closed."
No, can you not have those thoughts?
It's,
my God.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, all right, so events leading up to the Office.
Mm-hmm. A little show
events,
that could.
Well, I was in New York for 3 years after for the whole Valley of the Dolls thing in total. And then I came back. I was also singing in a band with John Flansburg from They Might Be Giants. He had another band called Monopuff. We would open for the Giants. They were sort of an alternative.
Monopuff.
Yes. And I did a little recording with them. But we were sort of characters. And then I also had this comedy act called The Lampshades, which I started to do that in Chicago years before. And I was doing the character on my own at certain comedy clubs. But then my comedy partner, Scott Robinson, was out here in L.A. So when I moved back, we just decided to do it. So since 2001, we've actually still been doing it. It's a dying lounge act. We do mashups of 70s and 80s songs. And we play a lot of comedy festivals and music festivals, and we play once a month now at Flappers in Burbank. We're I think we're opening for Puddle's Pity Party in May at the Rose on May 18th.
Oh,
so we do a lot of, like, because we do covers, we are very connected to the people that do comedy covers. Like we've opened for Richard Cheese and the Dan Band. We're kind of that world. So that was kind of what was taking up most of my time when I got back, was The Lampshades, and just kind of building this thing. And
are you a Joe Stafford fan?
Oh, sure.
Because that's, my dad loves all of the
Jonathan and Darlene Edwards recordings.
Oh, I gotta listen.
Oh, do you know?
I don't know. I have her on some of my best. Yeah, I gotta check it out.
Because we
do, like, I mean, you know, we do things that we were almost on Mad TV. They hired us for four songs, like we were gonna be on for 4 weeks in a row, and then they realized they couldn't afford the song rights.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, God.
So this was like and you know, and then I was doing some guest starring. I'd been on Bernie Mac. I was on Curb Your Enthusiasm as a cop. I think all my lines got cut, but I made a face, so I got a laugh. Theme of things to come. But yeah, I think it was just like that sort of chugging away. But I was, I remember, like, I always had a flyer in my pocket at the restaurant. So, you know, I invited people. And I remember Howard Morris used to come from time to time. He's such a sweet guy, if you remember him from your show of shows.
Of
and, of course, Andy Griffith, and the voice of, like, every cartoon character in the 60s, like Adamant and Jughead and everything. The greatest. So I feel like I had some support and some angels. And then, you know, I basically just auditioned for The Office and got it, which is so cool. I mean, I auditioned for the pilot, didn't get the pilot because I auditioned for a different part. And then I ended up replacing somebody from the pilot. So crazy. So wow. you never know.
So then you find yourself, well, one step at a time.
Yes, yes, yes.
First, you get a job.
Yes.
This is a good thing, mm-hmm. a job.
Right.
Then you meet your ensemble.
Yes.
And
I already knew Steve Carell because I knew him from Second City.
Sure.
We were not in the same cast, but I knew him. Yeah.
All right. Tell us about fitting into and getting to know your castmates.
Well, it's so interesting. Greg Daniels, our showrunner in The Office, he asked us to bring as much paperwork as possible to actually look like we were doing office work.
Huh.
He wanted the cameras to be free to catch anyone at any time just doing their job. Mm-hmm. So I brought tax stuff. I brought some writing. Our computers didn't work the first season. But I just remember, you know, so I didn't do a lot of I didn't have that many lines in the first season, but it was really like watching the master at work, because Steve Carell is, I mean, he's an amazing actor.
Mm-hmm.
Above and beyond being an improviser, he is such a great actor, and he makes so many different choices for each. I've never seen somebody have such a bag of just ideas that are just accessible to him, and not, he's just fearless. He just would just try something else the next take or whatever. And, you know, Rainn Wilson, who is closer to his character than he admits, he doesn't know a lot about Battlestar Galactica. Really interesting, very wonderful, specific actor who again, makes great choices. John Krasinski at the beginning of his career, just adorable, smart, you know, really, you know, wanting to play. Jenna Fischer, I mean, just lovely. And I knew Angela Kinsey, too, because we were in an all-chick improv group called Bitch Planet, like 2 years before that, at Improv Olympic West on Hollywood Boulevard. So I already knew her. Oscar and I had mutual friends because he was from the Groundlings, and mm-hmm. there's some crossover, Second City, some fistfights in the parking lot over that. But no. Yeah, and then, you know, so it was just kind of like this cast was unfolding, but it was sort of like I wasn't sure what to expect. And also, when you replace somebody, then you realize you're replaceable. So I really was on my very best behavior. Yeah. Yeah. But it was, you know, and I did get to improvise during the first season and just a little bit, but it was like something that stuck and actually made a little bit of a splash. It was during the Alliance episode, or no, the healthcare episode, where we were challenging him. And it was, you know, and I'd said, like, the universe is different from a vagina. I still have a vagina, so I'm saying vagina in your podcast. But it was a thing where, like, our showrunner, I remember seeing him at the restaurant afterwards. He saw me at the restaurant. He completely ignored the fact that I was working, Greg, and he said, "I'm going back and forth. They I don't know if they're going to let me use the word vagina, but I love it. I'm hoping it says I'm really, really fighting to keep that scene in." So I love that he just, it was like I just ran into him. And he had no judgment about me being in this hideous white outfit with tie on, you know, with some stains. You know, and that's the thing. It's like this, and there are some people that I would see at the restaurant, some directors I worked with, who almost looked at me like I had a disease all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, that's on them. And luckily I was old enough to just be like, you know what, I'm resigned. Like, this is what I'm doing. But, you know, I mean, I also had worked a brunch that year where I had like 10 orange juices on a tray, slipped and fell, all the orange juice all over me. Had to run back in another one. No one had cleaned up the spot where so I fell again.
Oh, God.
It was twice. And I remember there was one actor's table. I'm not going to tell you who it is. They were so annoyed with me. And this actor's wife said, "You're disgusting." And I said, "You're right, I am. This is." And then I remember I went to Beatrice Straight's table. And Beatrice had had some dementia, but she had the great kind of dementia where she was really lovely. Mm. And she said,
my favorite kind.
Yeah, and she said, "You look beautiful." So, you know, there were some silver linings. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is, like, anytime anything funky happens, it, you know, you just have to pick yourself, whatever. I just go back to therapy, whatever you can do to process it. And,
all right. So, yeah. So season two.
Yes, we actually
a little more.
Yes, I actually quit the job. Yes, and then they. Well, there were about six of us that we were technically guest stars, even though we had a desk. Mm-hmm. So
sure.
There was a suspicion that, you know, I mean, they could have just plopped a red wig on somebody and just never had her turn around. So mm-hmm. Thank God they did not go that way. But we actually got actual contract during while we were shooting the Booze Cruise episode, which was so weird because we were down in Long Beach on this, you know, we were literally on a boat for the whole week staying in Long Beach because the hours were crazy. And we were on this like dinghy getting us back and forth in the fog. I was thinking, oh my God, we're going to die. We couldn't see anything. But it was, you know, but it was, that was sort of the moment where you're like, oh, this. And then Steve had done 40-Year-Old Virgin. It came out. He did it right after the pilot, but it came out between right at the beginning of us shooting season two, and it was huge. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh yeah!
It was
huge,
massive.
I remember at the opening, every funny comic act, like every funny lead guy came to. Like I remember Will Ferrell was there, Ben Stiller. Oh my God, I'm trying to think. Jim Carrey was there. It was like all these people were just checking him out.
Yeah.
It was really wild. And I remember having this feeling in the parking lot at the Arclight when I went to get my car and I was like, something big is about to happen. And I think that somehow we're getting affected by this. And boy, were we affected by it. You know, I mean, just to suddenly become the darlings of the network and to have just such a huge fan base, you know, relatively quickly, but right-sizedly, like correctly, like everything was... You know, we weren't a flash in the pan.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, so every season had more challenges. I did have a lot of, you know, times where I didn't have a line in the table read. And then they would give me my stuff afterwards. And, you know, I learned pretty quickly not to count lines. Because sometimes actors do that and they'll fight. They'll go on, they'll want to meet with the writers. But I had this feeling that I was one of the few people that was used for my physical comedy. Mm-hmm. And they were doing it so well that I thought, you know what, it's whatever this is, it's worth the wait. Whatever this is, like, I don't have to push. We'll see what happens. I mean, there'd be like, sometimes there'd be two episodes where I think I said one word.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, when we'd shoot it, I'd be like, but, you know, it was, I always felt like there was some wonderful chess game that the writers were doing with this character. So season four starts with Michael Scott coming in the parking lot, looking at the documentary camera, and he hits Meredith. He hits my character. So I actually got to do my own stunt. I hit the glass, fell off the top of the car, and they called me that week. I was on the Tonight Show for the first time. It was like, and my boyfriend who I met on the show during the end of season two, well, actually in the middle of season two, but he didn't ask me out to want it. He came to my comedy. I came to the Lampshades. We started dating between season two and three. He was filling in because he had been Jay Leno's photographer. He's the chief stills guy at NBC. So he was just happened to be working on the Tonight Show the day that I just happened. So it was like I was filling in for Joaquin Phoenix, I think. So thank you, Joaquin. Thanks for not being there. But yeah, so it was so not only did I get a show, I got a guy, and then suddenly we were, you know, acknowledged on television by Jay Leno. They put the cameras on him. It was just so crazy and wonderful. But, you know, luckily I was in my 40s. So,
well, see, that's the thing. Everything that you're saying comes with age in the best sense.
Well, without a doubt, explain for people who might not understand, why do you say luckily I was in my 40s?
Because you just see there's so many young kids that get jobs at a young age. They get TV shows or movies and they think it's going to last forever. Mm-hmm. The ego suddenly is driving the train and they're not paying attention to any signals. There's no sense of the longevity, the care that you have to take care of yourself to be around for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not an accident. You have to have a great team. You have to have good people around you. You have to be, you know, relatively sane or have the tools to stay as sane as possible and hopefully as positive as possible, because nobody wants to work with the number one on the call sheet. That's a nightmare, you know. Yeah.
But that's I always tell, I was spoiled by my dad because he's a really nice person.
Right.
And everyone likes him. And so the thing is, what I saw was, okay, you treat people well, they like you, and then good things happen. And so for me, even at a young age, I had no tolerance
right.
for the people who would come in. Look, being at ET, they would have, you know, fly by night come in.
I'm sure.
They'd say, oh, be a new host because we found you yesterday.
Right.
And they'd be gone in a week, in a month, in whatever it was. So you see it.
Yeah, or the people that would step over your dying corpse to get your job.
That's it.
Which is a huge, lovely phenomenon about this business. Yeah. Ooh. But yeah, it's real. And I think, you know, I think it started from Greg Daniels, too, who's a very sane showrunner, very smart, and a lot of them are smart, but he had a certain humility, and Steve Carell had a certain humility. He's a very shy guy. The mm-hmm. show was always more important than him. He was never mm-hmm. holding court. He's never holding anybody hostage to hear his jokes or any of that kind of stuff. And he really made sure if people started laughing or something and we were taking too long to do a scene because of that, he'd say, like, come on. Like, he just kind of remind us, like, because we're all on the same team.
Yep.
And I always felt like there was a fake non-hierarchy on mm-hmm. our set. Which, of course, there's a hierarchy, but they pretended like there wasn't. So mm-hmm. It felt very much like a family because we were all in that same room a lot. So when information got imparted, most of us knew about it all at the same time, which is, it's a lovely thing. Mm. It really is.
So
yeah. Respect. So, it's really.
Do you feel the show improved? Do you feel that it grew and
yes.
changed from season
yes.
to season?
Yes, we had great movie directors that came in. We had Harold Ramis, who did a number of episodes. We had Jason Reitman. We had J.J. Abrams, who I used to wait on, who remembered me, saw me at the Emmys, and said, "You used to be our waitress. We're so happy for you." I mean, there were some great people. We had Joss Whedon, mm-hmm. who happened to direct the episode where I had the bat caught in my head, which is kind of ironic because of the Buffy thing. We had Jon Favreau, who I knew from the Second City days. He was actually a host at Second City, but, you know, we used to be on the same improv team. We did Manson the Musical together at the Annoyance Theater. You know, all these full circle things. But really, it's that sense that, you know, people were really wanting to work on this. And then, obviously, the last 3 years, we had bigger names on the show. We had Idris Elba.
Right.
He wasn't quite the superstar that he is now, but he was so great to work with. Kathy Bates, of course. Mm-hmm. And we had James Spader, who was extremely intimidating because every time I saw him, I could see right. every movie. You know, I mean, it's just, you know.
You're human. You can't.
Now, what did those directors bring to the table?
You know what? I feel like they just elevated. It was like a spotlight on everything that was already right about the show.
Uh-huh.
They didn't really try to reinvent it, but they honored it by wanting to play.
Yeah.
And I think they really were fans, too, which is
sure.
so crazy.
Well, why else would they have done it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, they didn't have to. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, I mean, and as a, you know, a former Second City person, like, I remember seeing Harold Ramis at the 50th anniversary and feeling like, oh, my gosh, like, I now know, I've now worked with Harold Ramis. Like,
yeah.
somebody pinch
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, these, and again, I think being in my 40s and also just having, you know, I mean, I've definitely had some tough times and some humility. I mean, it's just some really humbling experiences in this business. And I slept on couches in New York for a really long time. I had shared my money with an ex-boyfriend. I shared credit cards with him. And just like, it was like the biggest mistake. And I had some undoing to do. But I felt like at least I knew I was always, you know, in a safe place and on the right track. And
right.
the gifts were clearly there. I just had to, you know, kind of do whatever it took to just stay in right. there, hang
now,
in there.
Now, the other thing that strikes me about The Office, and your character in particular, but, I mean, everybody on the show, the word fearless comes to
oh,
mind.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, really and truly.
Well, I didn't get a lot of notice when I was asked to be topless or do a stunt. There wasn't a lot of notice. So so it was just sort of like, are you in or are you out? Which is great. I would have, you know, like I would have liked a few more days if I was, you know, topless because I wanted to lose a little weight so my back didn't look fat. But whatever. That's my vanity insanity. But and thank
that's
God it wasn't HBO.
Anybody
yes.
would
vanity insanity.
Yes, anybody would act
yes, and this is not HBO, so thank God. You
yeah.
know, we're just dealing with, you know, some,
yeah.
Thank God. But yeah, I think that's part of the team, part of being in a team, too, and being in a family. You understand what people are capable of, and you trust them to do that. I did not shave my head. They asked me to shave my head, and I didn't. But we ended up having...
That's a good call on your
yeah,
part.
Yeah, we ended
a,
up having, like,
solid.
We had a great guy that did the Star Trek movie, Bald Cap, for
yep.
that woman in that, and Ed French. He teaches many people how to do it. So we had the creme de la creme. I have new respect for sci-fi folks after that experience.
I'll bet.
4 hours in, 2.5 hours to get it out because of all the wax by your hairline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, it's just, again, it was...
But a great sight gag. So,
absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, no. And I think it's just trusting. Like there was such a mutual sense of trust.
You knew that they weren't going to do anything that wasn't for a purpose. And
absolutely.
Meaning.
Absolutely.
They weren't going to embarrass you.
No.
They're embarrassing your character.
Yes. Right. Well, maybe.
But that's just it. They're
this
embarrassing your character
right.
in the context of the show.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very different.
They wouldn't put you out there in a way that wasn't safe.
This is true. This is true. And I learned so much about the balance of, you know, because we could improvise sometimes, but I really learned like when it would be effective and when it was just kind of, you know, hijacking something. You know what I mean? I watched the masters do it regularly, you know, Stephen Rain, and then occasionally when I did, it's like I understood when it was time to do it, when it was time to go there and when it wasn't, and kind of learning that balance. So, you know, so if I talk to students and, you know, I've talked to a lot of acting students, I always like to talk about, you know, so it was, I had to learn it on the job, but you might want to learn this ahead of time. So if you do improvise, make sure you do it when your character speaks, as opposed to like when you're off camera and somebody has to, it has to make sense. And
right.
It has to be in the context of, you can't change the storyline. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, it's odd that would actually go, you know, that would make it into an episode or.
Respect. There's a huge piece of that is respect, which is in anything you do.
Right. And a little fear. But that's just me.
Well, if no fear, no. You know,
nothing ventured, nothing gained.
I mean, fear is part of the ingredient, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. This is true.
If you weren't intimidated by some of the things you had to do there,
we'd be concerned for you.
You couldn't give the performance you do.
This is right. And I wouldn't be in this glamorous studio on Sunset Boulevard right now.
Well,
do
you like the view?
I know, right?
I mean, this is a vista, this view here.
It's something else.
It's one of the best concrete walls I've ever seen in my life. Well done.
I will confess to you that sometimes, Kate, we get distracted from our guests by the scenery out that window.
It's true. It's true.
It's just, you know, it's pretty spectacular.
Is that where the Coke cans are?
Do you see how many shades of gray we have in this room?
Just gray over here, gray over there.
That's a different movie, Jesse.
You know how long this dust has been on this floor? This is classic dust.
So talk about recognition. Now people start to recognize you from The Office because it was such a popular show.
Yes, yes.
And you were on such a long time.
Yes.
How'd that start to play with your head?
Well, luckily, it started when people just wanted to buy me a drink because I played a drunk. So, you know, that's actually a pretty great intro to suddenly becoming recognized and famous. I remember being nervous at one point a little overwhelmed. I remember being on the boardwalk in Ocean City, where I'd been a million times, or on the train from downtown Philadelphia to see my parents, and like suddenly feeling like these students would come up. And I remember having a little bit of a, you know, like, what's happening? But I also realized I'm not Britney Spears. No one's freaking, it's fine. And someone had knocked on my dad's door because they saw me go in. I wasn't home. And I remember being like, what are they doing? They shouldn't knock on the door. You know, it's just because my dad's older and I just didn't want him to have to get, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt like, but then my dad said, if they come back, just go and talk to them. Just get it over with. You know, I mean, in a good way. Like they're there because, you know, it's just like get over yourself. And also just remember that, you know, it may be the fifth time or the 50th time I've talked to somebody that's recognized me that day, but it's that person's first time. And they really have a connection. And I'm also, as a waitress, I remember every once in a while taking a chance and complimenting a star. And sometimes that was a big mistake, you know, and I remember getting kind of stepped on and like, okay, I'll never do that again. But you know, it's so you live and learn. And I think it's something that you make peace with. And I feel like actors who get recognized a lot who haven't made peace with it, it's like you need a new therapist or something. Work it out because it's a champagne problem. It is a champagne problem. Yeah. And whatever anxiety that's around it, there's something about it that is getting inflated. It's not real. You know what I mean? It's fine. It's fine. Yeah. You know, I'm not a pop star, but you know what I'm saying. But there is balance to it all.
I say to my dad, on certain days when he gets recognized multiple times, we'll be somewhere, and because it's not every day, it's not all the time. He's a film critic. If you're, you know, for some people, they grew up with him. Some people don't know who he is. It's okay. But when we'll have a day where people just, you know, oh my God, oh my God, I'll say to him afterwards, I go, remember this. For when we're having a shitty time later on and we're stressed or whatever it is, remember all the people that came up today. And he, of course, he's not, you know, I'm talking, yeah. like, talking about like you're not here. You know, it's not an egomaniac.
Like, you're not even right here.
He's not an egomaniac, but it's the kind right. of thing where it's like when you have a day like that, you go, see, this is what I remember. I mean, you said yeah. to me, hi, I'm Kate Flannery. I was on the show. And I'm like, no, I know.
Well,
I know who
know.
You are.
I mean, I don't assume because you don't know.
No.
You know, I mean.
Because you never want to be the person that goes, do you know how popular
I am? Yeah,
popular.
Yeah.
You never want to be that person.
Do you know who I am if you have to ask the question?
Do you know who I used to be?
We all know the answer.
Do you know who I wish I were? Yeah, I know.
I am John Krasinski. Do you know who I am?
All right. Now, let's get back to one key topic here.
Yes.
Movies.
Yes.
Some of your all-time favorite movies and why? Are they? Do you find that the favorites are ones that you saw as a kid and you maintain that love for them
a
over
lot,
the years?
A lot are. Yes, there's a lot of that. And some that I saw again, like I saw as a kid, didn't get it, now I get it. Mm-hmm. Like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn is one of those.
Oh.
I mean, I just...
Oh, heartbreaking.
I literally, I saw it at the festival a couple years ago, and I got to talk to Ted Donaldson, who played Neely, the son. But I used to wait on Dorothy McGuire when she was not well, or she was not engaging.
Yeah.
She was always with a nurse, but she was so beautiful. Even in her old age, she was just gorgeous, with high cheekbones. But that Irish story is so, it's. I mean, obviously, James Dunn's performance,
all I have to do is think about the song Annie Laurie.
I'm telling you.
And
I was inconsolable in the theater, Leonard. I saw it. Remember, they at the festival, sometimes if there's a movie that is popular, they'll show it again on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Encore showing.
And so I missed the first one, and I got to the encore. I literally couldn't stop crying. I was the noisiest crier. I was like that person in the dark. There's something about it. But, you know, there's something about the storytelling, and that's Illy Kazan, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
His
oh
first
my
movie.
God. Yeah. Oh my God. What a great first movie.
Yeah.
But I think there's also just the shared, collected, unconscious that we're all sharing watching these movies, and everyone has their own. They bring their own experience. I mean, my dad owned a bar. My dad had the rooms above the bar. His character, the character of James Gleason was much more like my dad, like than the bartender, you know, Howard Da Silva in The Lost Weekend. I love that James Gleason's character, Mr. McShane, offered the kids a job at the bar when their father died of the drink.
Yeah.
You know, that was my dad. I mean, my dad literally, somebody broke into my dad's station wagon and fell asleep. My dad gave that guy a job and a place to live for the next 35 years. That is just my dad.
Mm.
So there's some things, and it's so Irish, and it's
but universal,
Universal, yes,
but universal, this,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. yeah. There was some specific things, but yes,
film. And Peggy Ann Garner,
God, what a great performance,
just
absolutely,
just right.
And you know, and I love that Joan Blondell's in it, doing something that Joan doesn't always do.
Yeah,
she was a little ditzy, which was great. Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, there's so many musicals that I just it's like I have a need to. It's like recharging the battery, or you know, water. You know, like I need to go back to the well.
Right. And they always fuel.
Yes.
You. They recharge those batteries.
Yes, they do.
And they give you the sustenance.
Yes, this is true.
And they remind you why you got. Why you fell in love with movies in the first place.
Absolutely.
Really, you
know? Absolutely. I mean, there's such a healing quality. And it's funny. I remember seeing Ben Mankiewicz's wife, Lee. I had just come out of a screening of Barefoot in the Park.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't know what movie I saw. And she said, oh, did you cry at the last movie? And I was like, no. It was Barefoot in the Park. And then I said, oh, no, wait, I did. I cried during the credits. Because the song, it just brought back so many memories. I just remember being in my living room. I thought, oh, my gosh, like that's the thing. And also being in the dark with a bunch of people who all are invested in this film,
yes.
that has such a power.
Oh, yeah. It's, seeing a film not just with any audience, but with a simpatico audience.
Yep.
Boy, does that make a difference.
Wow, it's
My mom and I, they showed some years ago Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which was our favorite movie.
Yeah.
And the two of us trying not to sing along. And the thing is, you could hear everyone around you doing the exact same with this sort of like muffled, like.
So great.
Everybody wanting to sing. And it felt so good. Now, I've been lucky enough to see it a few times on a big screen. But man, it just doesn't get better than sitting with all those people.
Yeah, it's so true.
And we got to meet the lead, the lovely, oh my God, my mom and I plotzed backstage.
Jane Powell.
My dad interviewed Jane Powell.
She's lovely.
Oh my God, lovely. I didn't even.
She's
we have a photo,
lovely.
Me, mom, and her. We're just like the faces of like, oh God, this is the best day of my life. It was amazing.
It's real. I mean, you know, I used to work at Kate Melanini on the Monday nights when the Academy would go through those every year. Every week would be a different best of picture.
What would happen?
That's the first time. Yeah,
they would speak before the movie. They do a Q&A, and then they would come to the restaurant because they've seen it a million times.
Right. Sure.
So I would wait on the last four people that were still alive from Gone with the Wind. Right. This is like back when Anne Rutherford was alive. I'd wait on Cheetah Rivera and George Shakiris. Like I would, you know, all the people that were just like, oh yeah, and then everyone would convene afterwards. But that to me was. I just
that's the greatest.
It was amazing. And, yeah. I remember waiting on Nancy Sinatra with her mother, Nancy Sr., mm-hmm. as she was referred to, Jean Martin and Dina Martin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and even though the men are gone, you know, the royalty lives on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember there was some waitress who was too busy, and I said, you know what, let me just take them over. You don't even know who you're waiting on.
Yeah,
step aside.
Yeah, right.
I know. You know, but yeah, but it's these, you know, and I mean, of course, like, there's so many great performances by Frank Sinatra. I'm such a fan of From Here to Eternity. Mm-hmm. Again, a movie I saw when I was little but didn't really get it. And just having an understanding of Pearl Harbor and just like the actual event and the way that their consciousness opened, like, oh my gosh, we're actually going to be at war. This is happening. Mm. And also the interact, you know, and just how awful, you know, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me?
Ernest Borgnine.
What a great performance.
Well, you know the story he always used to tell. He always used to tell this story about, I think Frank Sinatra Jr. said to his dad when he first saw that movie as a young person, I want to kill that guy. If I ever meet that guy, I want to kill him.
Oh my gosh.
And his father said, no, you kiss him. He helped me win an Oscar.
That is so good. Oh my God.
I hope I'm telling it right, but I think
that's fantastic.
I work the Spirit Awards every year.
Yeah.
The Spirit Awards, and Tyne Daly was there this year. And it was that kind of a thing where she got out. She arrived early, one of the few that arrived early, and I'm losing my damn mind. Everyone's like, why is it? And I was like, you don't understand.
I used to wait on her. She used to get a butterscotch sundae.
Oh my God. I honestly didn't have the guts to go over. I really wanted to, but I couldn't. I just couldn't because I knew what was going to come out was
sometimes that's okay. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, I've had experiences where people are super emotional, and I also realize I'm representing so many other people too, which happens. I mean, we connect to the projects. We connect to, it's not just the actors. And, you know, I feel like as an actress who I literally could have been just a recurring character on the show, like, it's, I love that, like, just getting to have a presence on screen no matter what, if I speak or not, it's like there's still some gravitas to, and this happens in many, many movies too, mm-hmm. as we know, but it's I think it's just that that collective love and respect and mm-hmm. or whatever the emotion is that comes up with the movie, and everybody a part of it carries that, mm-hmm. so they better not be a douchebag.
That's right.
Well, boy, you sure know. Boy, do you have a mm-hmm. scorecard tucked away in your mind there, boy? Oh boy,
many movies.
What great experiences.
Yes, yeah.
Even the bad ones.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, not lost on me. Yeah.
It certainly is. Like a postgraduate course in human nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yes, because you do learn a lot about people when you wait on them. And it's interesting. I was literally at a premiere last week, I think for the movie The Chaperone, and I ran into someone who I used to wait on who was not very nice to me at all. Mm. Not nice to me at all. They don't remember that I used to wait on them.
Of course,
and they just know me from the office. And she just kept wanting to talk to me. And I thought, I would never spit in your food or spit in your food now. I don't wish you ill, but I'm not going to talk to you. You treated me like gum on your shoe. I mean, there's a thing, you know, and some people, I feel like if I have no memory of you, then you were fine. But you were either wonderful or you were the worst. Because I used to wait on Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, and they would have dinner with Estelle Reiner and Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
They were the greatest.
Yeah.
Even if there was a problem at the table, never not great. Never not wonderful. Mm-hmm. Never, never. Mm-hmm. So I talked to Mel last year at the, we're on a first name basis now. No, I
and Mel.
That.
You and Mel.
So I got to, he was at the festival last year. I got to talk to him about it. But so there are the good stories too.
Right.
Yeah.
Kate. We're so glad you're here.
Yeah, give me the CD.
Yes.
Are you touring?
I am. Jane Lynch and I did this Christmas album, A Swingin' Little Christmas, but it came out of this non-Christmas act that we have. We're kind of like the Rat Pack with a couple of broads. So we're singing. There's some fun. It's not like a hostage situation. You know, you're not strapped to this concert hall where everything is a ballad. But we're actually playing. I think we're playing in Minneapolis next month. And Janesville, Wisconsin. You can go to Jane Lynch Official and see the dates. And
Jane Lynch Official.
Official, yeah. And then we did a huge Christmas tour this last year. We did 23 cities, 32 shows in 34 shows in 32 days.
Wowie.
On a tour bus. We were like literally on the tour bus, which is in our 50s. Cool, but old. Yeah. But the album is wonderful. And I feel like, you know, if you're having a rough day, there's a lot of musical references on this. It's a jazz Christmas album.
Okay. And where do people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Kate Flannery. On Instagram at The Real Kate Flannery, because there's a fake Kate Flannery, but just go to The Real Kate Flannery.
I hate that girl.
Yeah, and then I still do the lampshades. You can go to thelampshades.com for any info about our live shows there too. And
this is such a great cover.
Yeah, my boyfriend actually shot it. Chris Hayson, he shot everything.
He's useful to have around.
Yes, he worked on one film. He was actually in a scene with Robert De Niro. He got to help set up the lighting. And what is the movie called? It's with Bruce. Oh, What Just Happened?
Okay.
Which I think it's Barry Levinson. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but yeah, my boyfriend Chris is actually in it, and Chris was in the finale with me he's in the finale in The Office. He plays the photographer when they reveal Pam's mural in the in the warehouse, and then he's dancing with Meredith at Dwight and Angela's wedding in front of Michael Scott and Dwight dancing. So he's getting recognized for being on the show.
Oh, I love it.
Because there's so many super fans.
Wow.
It's The Office really has this, like, because of Netflix and Nick at Night and Comedy Central.
The thing, too, though, is good shows last.
Well, this is true, but this has a particularly different.
Oh, no,
I think the internet, the streaming thing has a whole different thing. Because I always say, like, if you're in a hospital and you don't have access to the remote, now you may have seen The Office.
Right.
It's on all the time now. It's on Cozy TV now, and it's oh my gosh.
But still, it's so awesome. You know, I know how we are. Frasier comes on. You know, there's certain shows that I will
watch. My boyfriend worked on Frasier. Yeah.
The Office is it's an easy show to have on. It's a fun show to have on. It is something you can count on.
Absolutely. Well, and luckily there's a movie star at the helm. So, you know, Steve Carell is, and I'm sure he's going to get an Academy Award before he gets an Emmy.
Well,
so I can't believe he never.
It.
Yeah, he does. He's an amazing actor and a really generous
nice
guy.
Man.
Yeah.
Lovely.
And a nice
lovely,
man.
Lovely, that's lovely, lovely. Absolutely. Leonard, you are so wonderful. I did wait on you, by the way, a long time ago, and you were lovely.
It's all lies.
It's true.
No. Well, thank goodness for that.
I wouldn't be here. Yes, you know I wouldn't be here otherwise.
Thanks for being here, Kate.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
We had a good time.
We did.
And
we'll see you at the festival.
We'll see you at TCM.
We wish you continued success, and we'll see you this weekend at TCM.
Can't wait.
And we'll see you folks next week. And in the meantime, if you want to find us.
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And that's also where you can find out all the information you need to know about Maltin Fest.
Maltin Fest.
Coming up May 10th through 12th at the Egyptian Theater
Hollywood. The Egyptian Theater.
Sid Grauman's Egyptian Theater.
You must be there.
I'm going to put some hot dogs in my purse.
We
and
need
go.
You to, oh
I can't wait.
My
I'm not
God.
Going to move. I'm not going to move.
It. We'll
can't
be in
wait.
It. We're so excited to tell you more about Maltin Fest. You can go to leonardmaltin.com and hit the tab Maltin Fest for all your information. We have to tell you about Paul Jarman and Design Circus. That's his company. You can go to Design Circus online, see everything he's done, and absolutely incredible guy. He created our logo and our poster. So happy to share his work with you all.
Anyway, we'll see you folks. Take care. Maltin on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.